Labor and Commerce will now come to order. It's 3:07 on March 26th. With us, we have Representative Gardner, Representative Gatto, Representative Book, and myself, Chair Olson. First item on the agenda today is Senate Bill 149, redistribution of used eyeglasses. Dave Stancliff will present. Welcome back, Dave.
Sure. Feels good to be back, Mr. Chairman. Dave Stancliff, staff to Senator Terrio. And it's a pleasure today to offer to you a very, very pleasurable piece of legislation to put forth. Senator Terrio was asked by the Lions to make it possible for the state of Alaska to work with them so that they can perform the type of services that they've been performing internationally in third world countries and now are performing in other states here in Alaska, and that is be able to take a person with a prescription from a licensed optometrist, ophthalmologist, and be able to fit them with refurbished eyeglasses. And those of you familiar with the Lions Club know that they're very, very dedicated to helping people whose vision isn't what it should be. They're estimating that probably in the neighborhood of 1,500 or so Alaskans would be helped under this particular arrangement. It's important to note, Mr. Chairman, that Senate Bill 149 does not require that the state grant this particular nonprofit or any nonprofit a carte blanche authority, but they, when they approached the state of Alaska, they were told that the statutes need to be widened just a bit so that the state could look at them as a nonprofit, because presently the only people that can fit and fit a person with eyeglasses has to be a licensed optometrist or ophthalmologist. I can give you a little bit of history on the legislation in terms of the way it would work is that the Lions Club or an otherwise qualified nonprofit, we couldn't cite them specifically, of course, would work with the department to demonstrate their ability to meet state standards in fitting used eyeglasses as prescribed by the physician. If the department grants permission to the Lions, then the following would happen. A person would present a prescription obtained from an optometrist or licensed physician. That would probably be an ophthalmologist in all likelihood. And the Lions Club would work with the person to find and fit free of charge those used eyeglasses. There has been no opposition to this legislation. The administration is on record as supporting this legislation. And I believe there may be some people online better qualified than myself from the Lions Clubs who might answer any specific questions you'd have of what they do specifically.
And actually, we have one person online, but any questions for Dave? Representative Book, followed by Representative Gardner.
I have three questions, and through the chair, Legislative Aide Stancliff. First of all, you outlined the procedure. There's glasses that are used, they're left over. You have a prescription that somebody comes in with, is what you stated, mm-hmm. and then they are fitted with a pair of glasses that most closely represent that prescription. Is that correct?
That's correct.
I guess my biggest question is who determines that these glasses and the prescriptions are appropriate?
Mr. Chairman, this is part of what the Lions have been doing for a long period of time. They are, and they'll speak more eloquently and specifically than I would, but they are equipped and trained, and the state would have to ascertain that they have the proper equipment and training to provide that fitting and that service. That is the key to this legislation, is allowing the state to at least review the program they have in place and the qualifications and the methods and means they use. And if the state department determines that that is permissible, then they would move forward. This, as I say, this is not a blank check, though, Representative Book. There would be standards that would have to be met.
Right.
That's question one.
Yes, question. following that up, I guess my concern is that, you know, in this game, it's not like hand grenades. You know, if you get a prescription and you get a set of glasses that are close to that, not quite the same. Are you not impairing the vision of that person? But I guess I'm going to look through your legislation here and see what the standards are and what kind of qualifications that that are required. And then the last question I have, you do mention in the bill that other groups with these same qualifications would be able to provide this same service. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, basically when you as policymakers make a decision, you have to not be specific perhaps to one group. And so at this time, I know of no other groups that are so qualified or would even have an interest in applying. However, the door should not be shut should other groups come up to those standards that the state set. And so in an effort not to become too specialized with this piece of legislation, chose to use other qualified nonprofits.
That's only two.
Well, it was a combined question.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've reached an age myself where I need glasses sometimes. When I need them, I go to Costco and I buy a three-pack, and I think these look about right. Sometimes they don't fit my face. Sometimes I bend the nose. I bend these. I sit on them. They're really not fitted to me. I've never had a pair of glasses fitted to me, and I'm sort of surprised to hear you say there are state standards for fitting glasses.
Well, the standards for people to be able to do that, obviously, the state at this time, it would be an optical shop that works under the supervision of a licensed optometrist. And so I think I can't presuppose what the state would require from the Lions, except probably to demonstrate to them that they understand the technical aspects of fitting glasses, the technical aspects of matching prescriptions, and have a track record of being able to provide this service. And I believe they have that internationally. They just don't have it in the state because we haven't granted permission yet. So when I say standards, the state will, I'm sure, have to be satisfied that they're qualified to do what they want to do. There is a caveat in this bill that in on page 2, line 24, you'll notice the words, and this was added in the previous body, to the extent possible. The eyeglasses conform to the extent possible. What the Lions have found is there are a lot of people that whose vision is really off the charts bad, and a prescription that they can't meet perfectly but very closely makes a huge difference in this person's ability to learn and enjoy life. You might also not know that, Mr. Chairman, that the Lions, for people who can't afford to go and get a prescription, raise and make money and funds available so people can go and get the prescription. But after I got my prescription, these little babies were almost $500. And as you know, they're not going down. I probably could have had heavy metal frames with real glass or something and maybe chopped it to $350. With this bill and this permission, now those people that have had help to get the prescription can now get a decent pair of glasses fitted to them by the Lions. And that's what this opens the door to, the possibility of that happening.
Paula?
I think it's a wonderful program. I mean, I support it all the way, and I'm really glad to hear you say that about assistance with getting the prescription, because my next question is, not only are fittings not exact, but even if you do go and get your own prescription, your eyes change, you may not get new glasses, and I don't think it's really essential for health to have the prescription be the exact one. So then my question is, if we have the nonprofit groups with a big collection of used glasses, I'm just sort of wondering, why do we require that people have a prescription in order to have access to those glasses?
Mr. Chairman, I wished I could answer that question. I think at some point, as policymakers and in the world of regulation, you have to set some reasonable standard, and that standard may change in the future, but for right now, it is set at that a person who is going to be fitted with eyeglasses, have it done legally in this state, has to be under the auspices of a licensed optician or ophthalmologist. I would think the Lions might be able to offer testimony that in other areas of the world where that isn't possible, they're doing more than they're asking to be able to do under this legislation. But I think when you start rubbing up against the existing system, you probably get some pushback if we went too far in that area. That's just a guess on my part, Mr. Chairman.
We've been joined by Representative Ledoux, and I think we'll talk to Fairbanks. Howard Rixey, are you with us?
Yes, sir, I am.
Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
My name's Howard Rixey, and I am representing the Aurora Borealis Lions Eyeglass Recycling Center.
So you're the man with all the answers.
Yes, sir. Actually, I think I can answer some of those questions that were just asked.
Please continue.
If I may, I'd like to just read the same statement I gave the Senate and then address the questions afterwards.
That'll work.
So good afternoon, committee members. I am Howard Rixey. I'm here today representing the Aurora Borealis Lions Eyeglass Recycling Center of North Pole, Alaska, and the 75-plus Lions clubs across the last frontier which support it. I am here to speak in favor of Senate Bill 149. And I remind you, in 1925, Helen Keller had asked the Lions, "Will you not help me hasten the day when there shall be no preventable blindness, no little deaf blind child untaught, no blind man or woman unaided? I appeal to you, Lions, will you not constitute yourselves Knights of the Blind in this crusade against darkness?" We are the Knights of the Blind, and we take a very active part in a crusade against darkness. We are urging the ones... We are the ones who urged Senator Thurl to sponsor this bill. Our urging was predicated on two projects we very actively and aggressively support, namely eyeglass recycling and eye care for the needy. Annually across our vast territory, approximately 1,500 people are referred to us for eye exams and eyeglasses, and sometimes other major eye care needs, i.e. surgeries. Through our process, though our process may vary in our different service areas, it typically involves someone referring a needy client to us, where we refer them to a local state public assistance or health service representative to establish the validity of their need. They validate whether the person is eligible for assistance under other programs, i.e. Denali Kid Care, Medicare, the VA, etc. If the person is found to be truly in need, their situation and circumstances are referred to us. We find a Lions Club to sponsor them financially, where they agree to pay the fees on the person's behalf. In the interior, we have a standing agreement with local eye doctors who provide eye exams at a flat rate of $60 and eyeglasses at a flat rate of $110, for a total of $170 per person assisted. But even the Lions' resources are constrained. The costs of our eye care programs are for the needy is daunting, and many times valid persons in need have to go on a wait list until resources become available. Our other project, Eyeglass Recycling Project, it involves approximately 30,000 to 40,000 pairs of glasses being collected and sent to our recycling center in North Pole. At that location, volunteers give up thousands of hours to sort, clean, inspect, repair, package, and ship approximately 30,000 pairs of ready-to-wear eyeglasses throughout the world to support vision care health missions in third world countries. All of this happens while many people in Alaska go without. We researched whether we could redistribute eyeglasses within Alaska. We were told the Alaska laws do not preclude it, nor does it enable it. To make sure we stood on firm footing and didn't violate any statutes, we urged the making of Senate Bill 149. In the very end, we envision each eye doctor donating one or two Saturdays a year to give free eye exams, meaning we could offer free eye exams once or twice a month. We also hope that somewhere amongst the thousands of ready-to-wear eyeglasses, there will be a pair that meets the doctor's prescription. So the needy person not only gets a free eye exam, but also gets a free pair of glasses immediately. We believe this vision of the eye care for the needy will reduce eye care from $170 down to about 25 cents. More importantly, 1,500 more people each year will enjoy the gifts that site brings. Lions do not want to corner the market, so to speak, on filling this need. We just want the statute's language to be enabling, to help us give the gift of sight, helping eyes see with the same clarity as you and I. Some may say we are taking income-making opportunities away from the eye care professionals. I would argue that if we did not serve the needs of these needy people, they would never get an eye exam nor a pair of glasses. I contend that these folks are not active consumers in the eye care industry, and they won't become one until they have a job that produces sufficient income or a way of life that produces a quality of life. A job that produces sufficient income or a way of life that places quality of life vision sufficiently in the forefront for the need to be acted on in a consumer way. Most, if not all, of the people we help are people whose social or economic plight forces them to put their focus on priorities elsewhere. These folks are homeless, battered, displaced, and or severely poor. More often than not, by giving eyeglasses to these folks means the difference in giving these folks a job and putting food on the table regularly. We thank the committee for hearing the bill, and we hope you advance the bill to the floor of the House for immediate adoption. And if I may just address some of the questions, I think what would be helpful is, one, define the three types of eye care professionals. An ophthalmologist is a person who primarily deals with the study of eye disease, if you would, and typically does all the surgeries. The optometrist is primarily most of what we see is people go to them and they get the prescription. Even though an ophthalmologist may do the same thing, an optometrist is the one that gives the prescriptions. And then you have an optician. An optician are those folks that just, they're the ones running the eyeglass shops. And what those folks do is actually take the prescriptions that either the ophthalmologist or the optometrist have issued and actually, if you would, manufacture and fit the eyeglasses for the person in need. So where does the lines come into play here? What we really want to do, I mean, ideal situation, that Saturday we're giving out free eye exams, so I've got an optometrist out in the eye exam room doing their prescription stuff, and then they walk out with the prescription in hand, and we might be partnered with opticians or maybe opticians or ophthalmologists or optometrists out in our other area, helping us sort through the glasses that we have to meet that prescription need. Eventually, yes, we would like, in some cases, for Lyons to actually be able to do what the opticians do as far as fitting or interpreting the prescriptions. Not always are we going to have a perfect fit, and so what we have is what we call a near-perfect fit, and that is what is used in the third-world countries. The near-perfect could, in fact, be defined by the standard that was coming in question here. We hope to negotiate with the state. There might be a standard where an optometrist might say, this person needs glasses at a prescription of, say, 1.50, and if the Lyons can get it within plus or minus 0.25, and that would be an acceptable standard or a near-perfect fit. So that's kind of how we envision it. There's going to be some things that we're going to have to work around with the state as far as standards go, because not all of our Lyons or communities have optometrists or opticians in their area. So there might be some teleconferencing going on or whatever the case may be. Hopefully that addresses your question.
Any questions for Mr. Rixey? Thanks again, Mr. Rixey. I'd like the record to reflect we've been joined by Representative Ramirez. Do we have anybody else online that would care to testify? We'll bring it back into the room. And is there anybody in the room that would care to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we'll close out public testimony and bring it back to the committee. Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is an excellent bill. I'm wondering if it's really essential to require a prescription in order to allow people to be fitted with used glasses. I'm thinking the Goodwill. You donate your glasses to the Goodwill. They have stacks of them. You can walk in, try them on. These don't work. These don't work. These work. Okay, and they go away. And maybe it's not perfect. Maybe you get a headache, but you're better. Maybe you're better off than you were before. But I'm not sure we want to tackle that at this point. I mean, it's a great program. I'm willing to support it going forward now. So it's kind of a rhetorical question.
So you're saying you don't have the overwhelming urge to amend it?
No, I don't.
Okay, just making sure.
Not this one.
Representative Ramirez.
Well, Mr. Chairman, wouldn't we subscribe to the Hippocratic Oath, which is do no harm first? I mean, and you want to have a good fit. That's the whole idea. We try not to degrade the degree of service. I've had the same conversation with Representative Crawford, actually, about dental hygienists, in that when we expand duties, do we inadvertently cause a degradation of service for those that are being the beneficiary of care less provided for than a dentist? And the same thing with glasses. I mean, I've had worn the wrong prescription contacts or reversed them in my eyes or glasses, and you do get a headache, and it's not appropriate care. I mean, I don't think, as a matter of principle, we should be moving legislation that's not appropriate care. I mean, it's a fit is a fit is a fit.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I guess my point is to not let the perfect be the enemy of the good enough. And it's not like dental work that maybe you can do damage that can't be undone. We're talking about used eyeglasses that if not working for you, you take them off. Are you any worse off than you were before you put them on? Sure, it's great to have them perfectly fitted, perfect prescription, perfect glasses. But for people who otherwise maybe have no eye care whatsoever, the good enough may be adequate. If they're, you know, as the bill sponsor's staff was talking about, or I'm sorry, it was the gentleman on the phone, Mr. Rixey, was talking about in places in rural Alaska where there is no optometrist, there's nobody there to actually fit them, they can try to use telemedicine and try to make some accommodation, and I'm just saying this is possibly another accommodation.
Representative Ledoux.
So I understand the way the law works now. Anybody can sell all sorts of eyeglasses, new, used, or what have you. Am I correct about that?
Mr. Chairman, I think to a degree you can go in and you can purchase off the rack in some of the stores glasses that you feel when you put them on correct your vision. The Lions and the professionals in the business, of course, take that a notch further, Representative.
So without this new bill, the Lions Club isn't allowed to help people fit their, I mean, what have they been doing for the past 50 years or so, ever since they got into the eye program? Have they been helping people?
An excellent question for Mr. Rixey, who would have the testimony, I believe.
Mr. Rixey, are you still with us?
Yes, I am, sir.
You want to tackle that one, please?
I will tell you, it's from an Alaska standpoint. All we have been able to do is to do it by working with local eye doctors for them to do the eye exams and us creating some type of subsidy to purchase glasses. We have not been allowed to give out glasses, just throw them out on the table or whatever. As a matter of fact, the eye care professionals have threatened us that if we were to do something like that, that they would take action of some sort. And to be quite frank, we are wanting to do something better than just people sorting through a bunch of glasses and trying them on one after the other to find the one that works and doesn't give them headaches. I mean, you got to keep in mind that there's 50,000 different possible prescriptions that a person might need. Our particular program will actually help sort that out and facilitate the person getting one that is closely, if not perfectly, fit for them. Ideally, if it's not closely fit for them, I mean, as far as perfect fit goes, it would be more of an under-prescription, if you would, versus an over-prescription.
Follow-up?
Okay, so now I'm really confused, because I thought I heard you saying that you wouldn't be able to just throw the eyeglasses out on a table right now and that people take their pick of them. But, I mean, isn't that what happens in Goodwill? Isn't that what happens in Walmart or Safeway or wherever else you get your glasses?
Through the chair, sir. Ma'am, that's exactly what happens when you go get the drugstore cheaters out of Walmart or whatever, is you try it. Trial by error on your own part there. I don't know what the deal is as far as the statues and everything else go, but considering that these glasses that we're processing are prescribed for somebody else who has turned them in and we've processed them, they're treated differently. Initially, when we were exploring this, we sent a letter to, I believe it was the Attorney General, forgive me if I can't remember exactly, and we kind of asked for a read on this, and the response was, is the statutes do not enable us, nor do they disallow us to do this. And we just wanted firm fitting that if we were going to have any kind of program out there, that we would be on good firm footing as far as the statutes go. At the same time, we want to do things most right. And I think that speaks to Representative Ramos's concern there as far as we don't want to do any harm in what we offer. Because I believe, if we were to just ideally throw the glasses out on the table and people sort through them and whatnot, and someone does somehow, some way have an adverse effect to it, technically they would probably be able to come back to Lyons and hold some form of liability, I'm sure, in this day of lawsuits and everything else. This bill makes it all clean, and all it really truly does is focus on enabling or empowering people that have these resources available to distribute them. The actual dispensing of them, the standards and everything else, that is kind of the second part. That comes after this particular bill. Hopefully that helps clarify this muddy water.
Follow up?
I'd like to ask you a question,
sure.
If I can. Is there a legal opinion or anything that says that this sounds like a great idea, but I just am wondering whether or not it's really necessary, whether it's needed in legislation? Because as Representative Gardner said, you can go into Goodwill now. You can get these glasses, which are used glasses. So I guess I'm just kind of wondering.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, that's a very legitimate question. And I think the answer to that question is we have a nonprofit who takes what they do extremely seriously. And they have come to you, the policymakers, saying, we want your permission and knowledge and understanding that we're going to take this a notch above Goodwill or just picking out glasses. That we're going to work with the state agency, who will probably develop some regulations to set standards for this nonprofit, so that we provide the best possible care that we can within our capabilities to carry this benevolent effort out. So I think this is your opportunity to make sure that your constituents receive the highest level of care, as opposed to just someone just putting glasses on a table. So this is an attempt by this organization to meet the highest standard they can meet and to work with our state agencies. And I think they should be applauded that they've approached it that way, because I think Representative Ramos's point is right on. Do no harm. Do no harm.
Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The fact that Goodwill, I believe they sell them, I don't know, but the fact that you're giving them away for free, does that give you any liability, or are you free from liability completely because they're free? You start fitting somebody to glasses, they come back with a headache. They say, you gave me bad glasses, I fell and broke them, and now I've hurt my... Is this bill going to give you freedom from liability?
Mr. Chairman, I certainly can't answer that, and I don't know that there's ever a guarantee from freedom of liability. I do believe, though, that taking this route and working closely with the state agency and in line with standards that are set, that's the best protection they probably would have from liability. And Mr. Rixey may wish to address that in more detail, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Rixey.
Yes, sir. In regard to that, I'm sure that, just like it's been already said, that we're probably never going to be free from total liability. But we're prepared. I mean, we have $1 million liability insurance that backs us up at the international level, and we're not concerned about that. But I think this is the most equitable compromise to meet all concerns, both from the eye care professionals, and doing no wrong, if you would, as far as the eye care that we're trying to offer, and making these 40,000 pairs of glasses available to our Alaskans, and doing it in the most prudent way, if you would.
Thank you very much again.
Thank you.
Representative Gardner.
I have a question for Mr. Rixey, and that is, sort of just for my personal interest, when you have a pair of glasses, prescription glasses, is there some identifier on them as to what they are, what the prescription is? Or does somebody have to kind of calculate that?
If I may?
Please.
Yes, ma'am. If you get the drugstore cheaters from Walmart, to use that example, that's already been used, usually on the sides of the frames, they actually show, say 1.5 or 1.75 or whatever the prescription might be. And the glasses that are generated through the opticians and through the optometrists and not, typically the prescription is not on there because there might be variations between one lens and the other. So when we process them, so we clean them, inspect them, sort them, repair them, and all that, and the very last step before they get packaged is we put them through a lensometer, and it actually reads the exact prescription for each lens, and then we print it out and put it on the bag and whatnot. So it's very precise as far as this reader goes.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Representative Gatto.
Well, Mr. Chair, I have cheaters. Mine say China.
I can't read mine because I have to keep my glasses on. Yeah,
what is the wish of the committee?
Mr. Chair, I'd be very happy to move House Bill 149.
Senate Bill.
I'm sorry, is it Senate Bill?
2.25.
Senate Bill 149 with individual recommendations and attached, I suppose, there's a zero fiscal note.
Yes, there is a zero.
Seeing no opposition, we'll move it up. Pardon me?
It's the Senate Labor and Commerce version.
Correct. K.
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 Version K.
Seeing no opposition, we'll move it out of committee and take a brief at ease.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. Thank Thanks, you very
much. Next item on the agenda is House Bill 258, Pawnbroker Bill, and with us is Josh Appleby from Representative Rose's office. Greetings. Long time no see.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, the first time before your committee this year.
This year.
This year.
Labor and Commerce?
After being committee aide for so many years, yeah. And the great faces that are still around.
For the new ones. The people that aren't in the rooms, please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, my name is Josh Appleby. I'm staff to Representative Bob Roses. Thank you very much. I'm here today to present House Bill 258, an act relating to pawnbrokers. House Bill 258, we're going to modernize, update, and regulate and bring some added consumer protections to the pawnbroker industry. And really what we're going to do is bring the industry into the 21st century. The bill, as introduced, marries the best of current regulations that we found in different states. Right now, currently in statute, Section 0876 is the controlling statute under which pawnbrokers conduct their business. Really just a collection of a very few paragraphs that outline redemption periods, notices, record keeping, disposition of property. House Bill 258 outlines several new additions and creates a regulatory framework. We established regulation under the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. We increase licensing requirements and add fees to those licensing, those people requiring a license. We hold pawnbrokers to a higher standard by strengthening the relationship between pawnbrokers and the local public safety agencies. We bring a process for misappropriated properties so that if a piece of property is stolen and sold at a pawn shop, there's a process for redemption of that property. We have provisions that allow service members who've been called to active duty to not have to worry about that property that's at a pawn shop or added fees because they're called to duty, they're serving their country. We think that that's the last thing they should have to worry about. We standardize the fee structure while maintaining the same rate cap. We allow citizens who use a pawn shop for their financial needs a grace period, a 30-day grace period, to retrieve their personal belongings. This has been a long time coming, Mr. Chairman. We introduced a bill last year and worked on it extensively over the interim. We've been working with Mark Davis, the director of the Department of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing, and producing the sponsor statement that you have before you today. With his input, the input from industry, we put together this piece of legislation for your consideration. I really appreciate you adding this to your calendar. I know all your offices received a fax today from the AARP in support of this legislation. And I am here available to answer questions on the bill. We also have online some people who are in a better position to answer some specific questions about the pawing process, actual numbers, even how that process is handled in other states. And Mr. Chairman, I also believe that Mark Davis is on the phone.
Mark is, yeah.
To answer questions specifically from the department standpoint.
Any questions for Josh? Representative Ledoux.
Yeah, I've actually got a little problem on page 2, section 8, or section 08, where it talks about the book shall be open to the inspection of a peace officer at reasonable times.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we've been doing an awful lot of talk lately about privacy. And so I guess I'm not sure what the rationale is for opening up to the government the amount of somebody's loan, their name and address, the description of the property that they have pledged. I mean, if I ended up in a situation where I needed to go to a pawn shop, I'm not sure that I necessarily want anybody to have that information.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ledoux, there are a couple of situations that I could imagine law enforcement would want to come in and inspect the books. And the first one that comes to mind, of course, is potential theft, investigation of a theft. But maybe to put your mind a little bit more at ease, every financial institution in the state, whether it's federally chartered or state chartered, has this requirement for their loans right now. So what we're doing is we're holding the pawn shops to that same standard.
Actually, that puts my mind less at ease rather than more at ease.
Followed? Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have actually kind of a lot of questions, so I'll just sort of quit when somebody else wants to ask a question. But first of all, on page 2, line 3, gathering data from a customer, and the pawn shop or the owner of the business, the clerk, has to record the date, the name, his own name or her name, the name and name, age, and address of the customer. And I guess my first question is do they document the name, ask for any identification? Does somebody have to prove their age and address?
Mr. Chairman, absolutely. There is a requirement in this bill that they be 18 years or older, so it will be incumbent on the shop owner to make sure that that is that the person pledging the property is 18 years or older.
Okay. Next question.
Next question.
In the paragraph that Representative Ledoux was talking about, the recording of all the entries, and since there can't be blank lines left in between, it means the next person signing up can see everybody listed up above them. So that's partly a concern, but my question really is that later in this bill there's a provision for filing records, regular reports, either in paper form or electronically as determined by the peace officer. And so my question is, does that mean that the store owner would have to keep this log that can't have obliterated lines or empty spaces, and then they may also be required to file what's essentially the same data in electronic format? So if I were running a business where I had to file something electronically, I'd want to keep the original data electronically so I'm not transferring it and then entering it here. But they can't do that given the provisions of obliterations and alterations not allowed. You can't you know, put a spreadsheet up and put all that in there. So,
Mr. Chairman, I think what we're trying to do here is set up a process where, whether it be law enforcement or departmental personnel who's doing a review, can actually go back and verify that the pawn transaction was done correctly, or that, you know, there wasn't somebody trying to, you know, write half of their name and kind of smudge it out or something like that. But specifically in regards to the electronic question, there are municipalities like Anchorage that will probably have an electronic system that will connect the pawn shops to the Department of Public Safety. But there will probably be towns or, you know, unincorporated boroughs that may not have that next technological step. So we wanted to make sure that it was kind of, we could cover both sides. You know, because some, there'll be some public safety departments that will have the ability to do it electronically, and that's certainly the most efficient. If some of your property gets stolen and you report it to the police, and the police can look it up on a computer to see if it's been sold to a pawn shop in a matter of hours, that would certainly be preferable. And if it's just one additional step for the pawn shop owner, I think, in a sense, the pawn shop owner is really covering, you know, their own liability as well.
Mr. Chair, I may come back to this when we get to the section about the reports, because I see that as an impediment to cooperation for an owner who maybe wants to accommodate all the needs, but they've got this written document that has signatures and everything, and then that same information, if you, you know, scan it in, that means the owner has to have the scanning equipment, and then it's not searchable in the same way that a spreadsheet would be, and therefore of less use to the municipality or to law enforcement in looking for the data. So,
Mr. Chairman, real quickly, I think probably some of the people online that can go through the process may be able to answer and see if it's really a burden or if it's something they do anyway.
Okay.
We've been joined by Representative Newman, and before I get to Representative Ledoux, it's not my intent to move the bill until we get somebody from the Department on Law online. I'm disappointed that we don't have anybody online today from the Department of Law, but we'll be holding the bill until we have somebody from the Department of Law to answer several questions. I know I have a few, and okay, as does Representative Gardner, but Representative Ledoux.
Do I understand you correctly that somehow or other the pawn shops and the information that the pawn shops have are going to be hooked up with the police department?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ledoux, it's possible. I think that there are software systems out there across the country that do just that.
I have a couple of follow-ups? So you were trying to set my mind at ease a few minutes ago by saying that all the information that was going to be in this book, that regular financial institutions have to have this, make this available also, like a bank. So are banks hooked up to the local police departments also?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ledoux, I don't believe that's the same case. It's my understanding that the electronic programs like this are designed to track just the property, not necessarily the name and everything. That's held at the pawn shop. But if, for example, you have a VCR and the VCR gets stolen and someone pawns it at a shop and the shop plugs in one VCR, serial number, whatever, you go to the police department, say, I've been robbed, they took my VCR, here's the serial number. The police department can then go to the computer and say, we know where your VCR is. It was sold at such and such pawn shop 2 hours ago.
Follow?
Just one more question. So I know that in the movies and everything, that when somebody's looted a house, that they'll go to the pawn shop or a fence or something like that. Are there, do you have, is there a history of this in Anchorage or the Valley or any place? I mean, what is the problem exactly that we're trying to fix here?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ledoux, I think what we're trying to do is to give some certainty that that pawn shops won't be used for that purpose, and provide some confidence on the behalf of people who do use pawn shops for non-nefarious purposes.
Just one more follow-up?
Certainly.
So is there a history? I mean, do we have somebody from the police department here who is going to tell us that for the past 10 or 15 or 20 years or what have you, that there is a history of pawn shops being used for this purpose, if we're trying to prevent it from assure that it's not going to happen? We've had pawn shops probably, it's probably one of the oldest professions.
Second oldest.
Mr. Chairman, lodging is right in there also.
Okay.
Short term.
Mr. Chairman.
There's a problem.
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe that we do have anybody from the police department online, but it would be a good question to talk to the people who are in the business, and they might be able to provide you with some statistics as far as, you know, how many requests they get from police departments to hold property. I think that would answer your question, and as far as relative to how much of a problem it really is.
Representative Boot, followed by Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have several questions as well. I commend the sponsor for bringing this bill forward and looking, you know, looking forward to working through some of the dilemmas that we face with this. Back on page 2, under Article 2, Section 876110, you have as a requirement, number one, has good character. That seems like a very broad requirement, and I'm just wondering how you establish that as a requirement for securing a license, as well as their fitness. It says they're fit to engage in this business. So I'm not asking for answers to these questions now. I'm just putting these on the list, and so that when we redress this at a future time, some of these are very, very broad kinds of requirements. And I'm assuming that under ASO 801060, you have already established these requirements and that these are parts of those requirements. But I just want to verify that. And then on page, yes.
To that point, Mr. Chair, if I might interrupt, I'd also be interested to know why somebody would have to already have business experience to engage in business as a pawnbroker, because you get a restaurant license, you don't necessarily have to have experience that in running a restaurant to meet health department requirements or whatever. So all three of those. Thank you.
Representative,
if I might continue.
Second question.
Yes. On page 3 on line 4, you're talking about a non-refundable initial investigation. Now, I'm just wondering what kind of an investigation. Credit, criminal, what sort of things would this entail? And if that's covered under AS 0876130, then those questions would be answered as well. So if you could get those to me. And for now, the final question that I have is on page 4, line 13. This refers to being able to make loans and interest. And I understand a couple of years ago, the legislature went through and they handled some payday loan requirements. And I want to know if that is covered under these two statutes as well, so that if there's limits that are established regarding the loan rates, if they're pertinent to this as well, and if they would be established, because some of these pawn shops, if you will, conduct several different types of business, and if they also conduct payday loans there, if it falls under this statute as well.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Boo, I can certainly answer that. We, when we worked on the payday lenders 2 years ago, we separated them out completely from this sort of business. So even if there's a business who does both pawns and payday lending, they are subject under the payday lending statute specifically, and under what would be the pawn statute specifically. They must keep those businesses separate, even though they're under the same roof.
Okay, and that's what's established by these statutes here? Is that what you're telling me?
Mr. Chairman, absolutely. That's the way the payday lending statutes were written, to separate that business and encapsulate it.
Appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Newman, followed by Representative Gardner. No, Representative Gardner.
Thank you. On page 4, and I believe that this is what Representative Book was just talking about under the line 13 amount financed, what this really is doing is removing the $500 pawn cash limit that is currently into statute. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
Okay. And then in the section immediately below that, under customer and transaction limitations, you're saying a pawnbroker may not knowingly enter into a pawnbroker transaction with a person who's under the influence of alcohol or controlled substance. And that is not required if it's not a pawn, if it's a sale, though, or purchase. Is that intentional that these two sections are sort of, or two elements of the business are treated differently? In both cases, the person, the customer has to be over 18, but it's only when it's a pawn that the person can't be under the influence.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if we want to get into the realm of preventing people from purchasing anything if they're under the influence of alcohol. We don't do that if we don't prevent people from going into a store and purchasing anything. I think the purchase transaction is different because at that point they're a customer. They're not pledging their property and entering into a loan agreement. They're merely providing payment for a product. And if we begin to say you can't go into a pawn shop and purchase a ring for the new love of your life that you just met, for example, I think we're treading on some dangerous ground by preventing people from, you know, exercising their right to purchase something, whether or not they may or may not be under the influence of alcohol or controlled substances.
So, Mr. Chair, follow up.
So
we're saying you can't purchase a ring for your beloved when you can't pawn a ring when you're under the influence, but you can purchase a ring. I'd say there's a certain danger in both. But in the same vein, it's also if you're pawning it, pawnbroker may not knowingly accept or receive misappropriated property, but if the pawnbroker is purchasing something in the business of buying and selling, that language isn't there. I'm just sort of, say again, it could be the same in both parts.
Mr. Chairman, I believe what we're doing is we're trying to, we want to make sure that there are customers who are entering into a transaction that is a financial transaction with a clear head. But I don't know if we really want to control their actions when it comes to actually just walking into a pawn shop and purchasing. I guess I don't see any difference if they walked into a pawn shop or a jewelry shop or a mall. At that point, the pawn shop acts much like any other storefront.
Mr. Chair, I would posit that if they're selling something and they're under the influence or the item might be misappropriated property, that would hold true whether they're selling it or pawning it.
Mr. Chairman, I think maybe we're saying the same thing. If someone walks into a pawn shop and wants to sell it to the pawn shop, I would agree with you.
Okay.
But if they're walking in and they want to purchase something, mm-hmm. then I don't think that we want to, you know, go down that road.
Maybe. We'll see.
Representative Ledoux.
Okay. We're still on page 4. And are you saying that 0876170 only applies to if you're taking a piece of property in to get some money on? It doesn't apply if you are purchasing something? Because it says pawnbroker transaction. So I would kind of think that purchasing something might be viewed as a pawnbroker transaction, especially because you have in this next section where it talks about record of pawnbroker transactions, and it talks about loans, purchase, or sales. Or am I missing something?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ledoux, I don't think when we talk about Section 170 and the customer and transaction limitations, certainly the intent is to make sure that the pawnbroker doesn't have somebody walk into their shop who's clearly under the influence or under 18 using somebody else's name and proceeds into a transaction with them.
Okay.
I mean, that's what we want to prohibit.
So you'd have no problem clarifying that so that it definitely excludes purchasing things from a pawn shop.
I have no problem, Mr.
Okay.
Chairman.
Then can we go to 180? What's the purpose of maintaining this list of every time somebody buys something from a pawn broker? I mean, if I go into a jewelry shop, if I go into Nordstrom's, you know, if I pay cash, nobody's keeping a list of my name, my address, and stuff like that. So why, if you go into a pawn shop, why would you be keeping that information?
Mr. Chairman, I believe when we talk about pawn shops and we talk about pawn transactions, really we want, again, to be assured that in the event that something does go wrong, we can go back and trace those transactions. Or if somebody has a habit of pawning items or selling items, this could be an indication of somebody who is, you know, steals a lot. You know, either they have a lot of property or, you know, they like to sell a lot of property.
Hello?
But suppose they're just purchasing. Maybe they make it a habit of, you know, going into pawn shops because sometimes there's nice ivory and jewelry and stuff like that there. And if you just go to a jewelry shop, nobody's keeping a record of all of your personal information. So why should they be keeping a record of your personal information if you're buying the stuff at a pawn shop?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that it's the intent that, you know, we want to, I guess what we're trying to do here is to establish a certain level of trustworthiness. I mean, everyone understands that for some reason, whether it be the movies or personal experience, that pawn shops tend to have a bad reputation. And so trying to keep all of their transactions as open and transparent as possible may be a way of alleviating that stigma that they currently suffer from.
Follow up?
No.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll keep it short. Hi, Josh. First, I ought to say that I don't really agree with the statement that pawn shops are maybe not top-of-the-line companies. I think there's some pretty good ones. I like going in and talking, being there myself. But I share the same concern that Representative Ledoux does, that talks about keeping a record of all the sales. So just for your notes, sir, I'm pretty concerned about that. And Representative Boot kind of zeroed in right on my first questions there about the department. I mean, so we have the DCCED. Somebody within DCCED has to judge a person's good character. Now, I hope you can give me some guidelines on how you judge a good character. And I'm sure you've had to think about this for a while because you're a pretty smart guy and you do your schoolwork. And so I'm assuming you, I don't know if you got any answers to that now, that'd be good, but, you know, fit to engage in business, and I'm not quite sure what that means either. we're giving a lot of authority to a mid-level bureaucrat to decide, I think, on some of these issues. But you see you're taking notes, I assume you probably want to talk about this later. But something I do have a question maybe you can talk about now is on page 3 where it says withdrawal of application. And the department may consider that a person is withdrawn. Again, you know, I guess that's the assumption of who's ever deciding if you're a fit character or not. But can these be done electronically? Or does this all have to be done in paper, or these application fees?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that the department would do most of this electronically. Certainly Mark Davis would be the best person to ask. As
Clarify that we can...
In fact, we'll be getting to Mark after we hear from three people that have signed up to testify on behalf of the industry, so we can get a different perspective.
Well, you know what, Mr. Chair, let's let them people talk. I like to let the people talk, so I'll hold my questions and let them go first.
Alex Vaughn, are you with us?
Yes, sir, I am.
Please state your name and affiliation, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Alex Vaughn. I'm a Vice President of Governmental Relations with Cash America International. We're a publicly traded company, actually traded on the New York Stock Exchange. Our symbol is CSH, and we're headquartered in Fort Worth, Texas, where I am today. Cash America provides financial services to individuals across the United States in 942 locations. We are the largest provider of pawn loans in the country. We have 499 pawn shops. Of that 499, 14 are franchise locations in 22 states, of which, Mr. Chairman, five of our stores are located in Anchorage. And I'm speaking before the committee in support of this bill because it does create a 21st century regulatory structure for my industry, and it protects the consumers and our customers. The substitute, at least the one that I've looked at, has licensing provisions, which have been talked about, oversight and regulation by a state agency, which I think is very important for this industry to have oversight and auditing from state agencies. And it removes, of course, it removes pawnbrokers from Title VI of the Small Loan Act and creates a completely new act with all of these regulatory pieces in place. And, of course, as you've discussed, some of the major provisions are uniform standards for licensing, investigation fees for the state to recover to make sure the pawnbrokers are legitimate businessmen trying to serve a legitimate need in the community. It provides a biannual report to the state for the pawn activity, and it strengthens the reporting relationship of pawn activity with the police department. It creates consumer protections for the military servicemen that Mr. Appleby had mentioned, and it standardizes the fee structure for the initial 30-day loan period, and it maintains at the same level the current finance rate. It also creates a new 30-day grace period for our customers to come back and retrieve their personal belongings. And in summary, the bill does create one of the most modern, up-to-date pawn statutes that we've had the opportunity to review. Many Americans today, Mr. Chairman, depend upon pawnbrokers to help them meet their financial needs not offered by other financial institutions. Pawn customers represent the working families who periodically experience unexpected needs for short-term finances. Pawn loans keep the electricity on and the rents paid. Cash America, my company, is constantly working to enhance the image of pawnbrokers while offering the needed services of our customers in the communities. Our stores are attractive. They're welcoming places to do business. Cash America is also a member of the National Pawnbrokers Association, which supports the mission to improve professional development and enhance the image of the industry by advocating for pawnbroker rights, responsibilities, and improving regulation of the industry. And I think this bill meets those criteria. And I appreciate Representative Rose's bringing it forward. I want to take just a few minutes to discuss how the pawn process works. Simply, a customer pledges personal property, brings it into our store as collateral in return for us to lend them money. When customers pay back the loan and the fees, their merchandise is returned to them. Pawn loans are made on every type of product from jewelry to electronics. If the customer elects not to redeem his property or his collateral, there is no credit consequences to that customer. And the items are then become property of the pawnbroker, and we will sell them to the retail customers that we talked about earlier. The average pawn loan in the United States is $75. For our stores in Alaska, our average pond loans are about $85. Redemption rates, which is the customers coming back to pick up their property, typically run 75 to 80% of all of our transactions. In Alaska, that redemption rate is around 51%. Contract periods, the length of terms for these pond contracts vary between states, but are typically 30 days with an additional 30-day grace period. And of course, currently, the law allows us in Alaska to have a 30-day term with no grace period. And this bill provides for that new grace period, which is consumer-friendly. It gives the opportunity to come back and get the property. Alaska's rates remains the same at 20% and are comparable to other western states such as Colorado, which is at 20%, Montana, which is at 25%, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Utah, for example, Mr. Chairman, have no pond rate caps. It's up to the market. Finally, pawnbrokers will be required to report all transactions to local law enforcement agencies to assist them in the investigation of property crimes. It is in the best interest of my customers, my coworkers, my investors, to eliminate any potential transaction involving stolen merchandise. And you're absolutely right. The conception or the perception in the media and Hollywood is that pawn shops are pipelines used by criminals to fence stolen property. And so I'm going to give you some statistics, Mr. Chairman, that shows that to be false. For the 12 months ending December of 2007, last December, Cash America's 485 company-owned store handled 9.6 million items and advanced $525 million in loans to our customers on 6 million different transactions. Of all of those transactions, only 4,484 of them were involved in any type of police hold or seizure. And that works out to about 0.5% of our annual transaction. In Alaska, we handled 127,000 items and advanced $5.7 million in loans to our customers on 79,976 transactions, of which 32, a very small number, was ever involved with a police hold. And again, that's a 0.3%. We have the responsibility to safeguard our customer information. I know several of the committee members are concerned about customer information, and that's the information we provide to external sources. We have the requirements to make sure under federal statutes like Graham, Leach, Bliley, that information is protected. We must ensure the security and confidentiality of the customer information, and we take this very seriously. This bill allows us to work with local and law enforcement by submitting the pawn transaction information, not their customer information, but the pawn transaction information directly to law enforcement. Law enforcement then uses the information obtained in the records of the pawn transaction in this bill will be confidential and limited to the investigation related to the recovery of stolen personal property. The information provided to law enforcement is protected and recognized in the same category as any other financial record, and that is identified as a private and confidential information of the pawnbroker and its customer. You know, House Bill 2258 provides many other improvements to the regulatory framework, in which all pawnbrokers, independents, and companies like mine can operate profitably while providing the state of Alaska some regulatory oversight. I thank you for the opportunity to speak, and I also have our local market manager, Mr. Kenneth Gudson, who's on the loans on the phone, that may be able to answer some of these questions. And Mr. Chairman, I'll be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
No, thank you, Representative Ledoux.
Okay, a couple of things. Thanks very much for coming and testifying. Now, I think that you said that you wouldn't be providing the name of the customer to the police department on a regular basis. Did I understand that correctly?
Yes, ma'am. And if I understand your concerns and questions, when you're talking about the police having the right to come into our store, it would also provide the state agency auditor to come in and make sure that we're keeping our records appropriate. And that's the reason that they would have access to the books and records, which can be both electronic and or paper form. As to the information that is turned over to the police departments, according to the bill as I read it, ma'am, those that record would only be the descriptional property, or description of the property, the date that the pond loan was made, the description of the property, how much we loaned against it, but it would not include customer name, address, social security number, driver's license, or any of that information that we would have in our record books. That's what would be shipped or sent to the police department. And one other thing is, at least from Cash America's perspective, that information, if I ship it electronically to the local law enforcement agency, I'll also encrypt it, as that's part of that requirements under the federal standards, that if it moves electronically, I encrypt that data.
Okay, I'm still confused. I'm looking at section 876.010, and I'm seeing that, and which is section 3 and section 4 of the bill. And section 3 says the transactions are the types of information that must be maintained. And it looks to me like one of those things is the name, age, and address of the customer. And then section 4 says that this book shall be open to the inspection of a peace officer at reasonable times. So it does look like to me that the police officers can be looking at all of this information whenever they want to.
Yes, ma'am, and again, that goes to the point that those records that are maintained at the store, as my company, I do not have a problem with the officer coming in or an agent of the state that's going to regulate me coming in and looking at my books and records to make sure that I'm meeting the requirements of the statute. As for the information I send to them, specifically, that information is solely transactional data. But yes, ma'am, I read it like you do. If they come to my store, if they come in and want to confirm that I am following the state statute, they would have access to look at my customer name on a reasonable basis.
Thank you.
Any further questions for Mr. Vaughn? Thank you again, Mr. Vaughn. Fernando Pena, are you with us? Do you have anything to add?
Fernando Pena, Cash America Government Affairs Director for the Western Region. I free up my time for the rest of the group. Thank you.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you. Kenneth Gudgeon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to address the committee and to speak for my support of House Bill 258. My name is Kenneth Gudgeon. I'm the market manager assigned to the state of Alaska. I would love to be in Juneau today, but unfortunately I was called away on business. I joined Cash America 8 years ago and transferred to Anchorage on July 29th of 2006. On that day, we completed the acquisition of the Cash Alaska pawn shop chain and the Alaska First Cash Pawn Shop in Anchorage. This gives us a total of 5 stores in the Anchorage area. We're the largest pawn organization in the city of Anchorage and the state of Alaska, and have the intention of expanding our businesses elsewhere in the state. We currently employ 48 people in the Anchorage area. With the acquisition and to the great excitement of our fellow employees, we brought a full benefits package with us. Our employees take advantage of health benefits, dental benefits, 401k and life insurance. We also offer bi-monthly training covering world-class customer service, sales training, and others for all of our employees. Our purpose here in Anchorage is not unlike our purpose everywhere we go. We're here to serve the community and offer our products and services in a clean and safe environment. Cash Alaska and Alaska First Cash Pawn Shops were both well-run and well-maintained organizations. We have built on that by not only the high level of customer service we strive for, but also remodeling all 5 of our current locations. We provide a clean, well-lit, well-organized facility for our customers to conduct their business in. Our core business is the pawn business. In 2007, we provided this service to over 29,000 residents at a total of $5.7 million out of our 5 pawn shops in Anchorage. These are Alaska citizens that use our services to advance their own personal lives. We write loans for many different purposes. Oftentimes it is spending money for a work week. Some loans are for expenses when their normal monthly funds come up a little short. We help fishermen who are out of season. We help folks who work in remote locations and can be without pay for several weeks. Some loans are for emergencies, such as broken down cars or surgery or time off work. These customers use their own valuable possessions as collateral to secure these loans. We do all we can to provide them with anything that they need. When given the opportunity to review this bill, I see many advantages and protections for both our business and for our customers. I would like to speak on two. We currently report all pawn transactions to the Anchorage Police Department. This includes the make, model, and serial number of all items taken in, as well as the name, driver's license, and birthday of the person pawning the item. We have, since day one, made it a priority to develop a good working relationship with the Anchorage Police Department. We do inevitably receive stolen merchandise. When this happens, we provide police with signatures, eyewitnesses, and surveillance video of the suspects. The victim is also able to recover the property that was stolen. The only reason we can give you statistics is because we have mandatory reporting laws here in Anchorage. We do not know at this time what goes on elsewhere in the state. Local law enforcement is powerless at this time to monitor this. This proposed legislation makes police reporting mandatory for all potential pawn license holders in the state. This protects both potential retail customers and the citizens at large. This also protects pawn shops. I believe this is a necessary for our industry to be productive contributors to the communities we work in. This bill also protects our many military customers. Similar to policies already in place in our stores by choice, this law protects those who serve our nation by guaranteeing their pawn merchandise will be available at no interest if the individual is called overseas. As you can imagine, this is a common occurrence in Alaska. Any merchandise pawned by a military serviceman or woman will be held interest-free until the individual returns home. This is important to all of us and all who serve. As stated earlier, we have five pawn shops in Anchorage. We deal with a large portion of the local population and are an integral part of the community. Our goal every day is to take good care of the people that we serve. We act with a servant's heart and do everything in our power to meet our customers' needs. We come from the community that we serve. State regulation, this proposed legislation, will benefit the entire community. With state oversight and police reporting, we will both legitimize and regulate a business that is an integral part of the community that they serve. Thank you very much for your time and the opportunity, Mr. Chairman, and I am also open to questions.
We have one question, Representative Gardner.
Thank you, and thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Gudgeon. I have a question about the military provisions. On page 7 of the bill, there's a description under how property pawned property can be redeemed. And then the section on the military talks about how a serviceman or woman would go about redeeming it. My question is this: if somebody comes into your store, pawns property, the time passes, the grace period passes, and you sell it, and then they come in and say they're in the military, they've already lost it, right? I mean, wouldn't there need to be a provision that at the outset, I mean, that they have to tell you they're leaving or something? Otherwise, how would you ever know until they come back? They've been gone a year, and the grace period was gone 6 months ago.
Yes, ma'am, I do understand that concern. And in practice, the way it works right now in our stores is exactly how you say that this would – we need to be notified, because you're exactly right. If John Smith pawns something and doesn't come back, we're going to put it out for sale. If he comes back in a year from Iraq, then you're exactly right. It's too late. It is something that we do have to be informed beforehand.
Thank you very much. So, Mr. Chair, that might be something we want to see added to the bill, so they would know.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Gudgeon. Mark Davis, are you questions only, or do you have something to add?
Mr. Chairman, this is Mark Davis. I'm the Director of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. I just briefly like to say that we're in support of licensing of this industry. It goes together with recent efforts to license money transmitters and deferred deposit lenders. But primarily, I'm here to answer questions.
So you're in support of the current version?
I'm in support of version. Yeah, I think from the questions today, there may be some refinement needed. And perhaps, for example, the questions is as to, like, good character in 08761110. The qualifications for deferred deposit lending are much more specific.
We've got at least one question for you, Mark. Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Davis, sure. And thanks for your testimony. On page 4 of the bill where there's a description of what the biennial report must provide, and it's the number of transactions, the aggregate amount financed, the number of items redeemed, the amount financed, and the value of the pledged property. You know, I can see that the state has an interest perhaps in knowing the VIN numbers or the ID numbers of pieces and trying to track potential theft issues. But what's the state interest in knowing the number and the amounts raised? Isn't that kind of proprietary information?
Representative to the chair, I think this would be aggregate information for the industry as a whole. That's why I read this. Be very similar to the reports that we prepare for banks, credit unions, and deferred deposit lending. It's informational to tell the legislature how big this industry is and what its trends are.
Thank you. So banks and other people talk about how many loans they make and what their average interest rate is? And
Representative, through the chair, our various reports cover different things, but with deferred deposit lending, we have the number of licensees, a bunch of information we report on banks. We have their aggregate size and their assets under control. So we would probably look at this through regulation and try to develop a report that provided an overall glimpse of how the industry is performing.
Thank you. I guess I'm not convinced that it's important for the state to know the profitability of a particular private location or store, but thank you.
Well, if I clarify, I don't think this will give you profitability. It'll just give you the number of transactions, like you've had already the testimony from Cash America on the number of transactions they've had and their average loan. And the number of items they have, the number of customers is very similar. And then the number of redemptions, which they already gave you that their redemption rate at 51%. So the industry is keeping this kind of data already.
Thank you.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Davis, on the fiscal note, it talks about there would be approximately 30 licensees under this legislation. Is there only 30 pawn shops in the state, do you think?
Representative Newman, through the chair, we asked for this information from the sponsor because the division does not license this industry, and we didn't know. So that was information we got from Representative Roses.
Okay, so the Division of Ock License doesn't issue them a license with a category under this?
Representative Newman, through the chair, we do not. We looked at a word search for pawn shop, but not everyone uses that in their business license name. For example, Cash America does not. So a business license search will not work.
I know when I fill out my business license, they're pretty specific. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Mr. Davis, I don't know if you heard our previous questions from Representative Buch and myself about the requirements for a license, the requirements that the applicant be of good character, be fit to engage in business as a pawnbroker, and has the experience to engage business as a pawnbroker. Do other business licenses that aren't, you know, of a medical nature or something like that require that the applicant have the experience to engage in that business or be fit to engage in it?
Yes, through the chair, they do. For example, 0650020 qualifications for deferred deposit lending license requires, quote, demonstrate financial responsibility, financial condition, business experience, character, and general fitness.
Thank you. So what if I were just wanting to open a pawn shop of my own and I could demonstrate that I had good character and was fit to engage in the business, but I had no experience whatsoever in the retail trade? Would that be an impediment to me being licensed?
Representative, through the chair, I don't think it should be, nor what I interpret it to be so. I think the experience to engage in business as a pawnbroker would mean the ability to understand the lending of money and risk involved in lending money, ability to maintain the records that are required by the licensing provisions, which could be satisfied by educational experience and or previous work experience. So I don't think this is a bar to entry, but it is appropriate in these in lending to make sure that the person knows what they're doing and has the necessary business acumen.
Thank you.
Any further questions for Mr. Davis? Thanks again, Mark. Is there anybody else online that would care to testify on this bill? I'm not going to close out public testimony today because we're going to track down Ed Snip, Snip and see if we can get Ed to weigh in for the Department of Law. And I don't see anybody in the room. Is there anybody in the room that would care to testify at this point in time? With that, I think we'll be holding on to the bill until we can track down the Department of Law. And with that, we'll adjourn at 4:35.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.